Good morning. Thank you, Leo, for your wonderful Zen meditative sounds. Leo Hansen. Okay, so this morning I'm going to talk about vehicles that are used on the path in Buddhist teaching, Buddhist practice. And I'm going to do that this week and then also next week. And I'm going to talk about the three main vehicles that are used, that are talked about. The vehicle of the solitary practitioner, the vehicle of the listener, and the vehicle of the bodhisattva. Only next time I'm going to, I'm not going to do the bodhisattva this time. I'm going to do the bodhisattva next time. So this path that some of you who haven't embarked on, and others of you maybe contemplating embarking on, has vehicles. Isn't that nice? And of course, in the traditional literature, they're generally carts. They're generally carts, which have animals attached to them. those vehicles on the path are to take us from samsara to nirvana, from our confused, anxious worries, fears, discouragement, to some just peace. So the path, as I talk about it, is not a path from here to there, but rather a path from there to here. Because we're already there. We're already worried about something. Or thinking we should be doing something else rather than sitting here. Or hoping that we'll get something out of this talk or something. We're already there. And this path is to come back here. So that's the path. From there to here. And nirvana, the path to here, the path to nirvana, is defined as to cool by blowing. By blowing, you cool. And by continuing to blow, that's with your meditation, just your breathing, just your meditation. The second definition is you blow out the obsession with the fictional self. You just blow that obsession out. And then the third definition, Buddha was asked about nirvana a lot, because people were much more interested in that than they were in samsara, right? So the third definition he gave was, nirvana is simply the reality of non-grasping. Just non-grasping. And when these vehicles are talked about, the vehicle of the solitary practitioner, the vehicle of the listener who's involved in a community, and the vehicle of the bodhisattva, they tend to be talked about hierarchically. But I'm not going to do that. We do that in Buddhism just like they do that in Christianity and just like they do that in all religions. We tend to find the best one and then we act pejoratively about the ones that are not as good. This seems to be human consciousness to do this. And you may be shocked to find it in Buddhism, but Buddhists are people too. And there it is. And so the Mahayanas, the yana means vehicle, right? The big vehicle folks were pejorative about the listeners and the private practitioners. They put them down. We've got the one true way, the Mahayana. And the Vajrayana came along. The Vajrayana said, well, the Mahayana, yeah, that was pretty good. That was pretty good. It was certainly better than the Hinayana, the little vehicle. But this is only preliminary to the Vajrayana, which is the tantric way of the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So we have this happening in the history of religion. You can't get away from it. We need to be kind of careful of it, because we get involved in it ourselves. We get attached ourselves to our own way of doing things. Our own belief system, our own non-belief system. So, I'm not going to do that this morning. I may do that in my life. I don't want to, but I may. You know, it just seems natural. So, I'll talk a little bit about, first of all, solitary practitioners, the solitary path. Solitary path, I think, is the oldest one. And if you have ever seen cave paintings at slides of cave paintings at Lascaux, France, 17,000 years ago, those are solitary people, solitary beings sitting in what we call zazen, just sitting, looking, doing nothing. And then we have Milarepa in the Tibetan tradition, sitting for years in a cave, meditating for years in a cave by himself. And then we have our own supposed founder, right? Bodhidharma. If he wasn't a solitary practitioner, who is? He doesn't talk about Sangha. He didn't talk about teacher. He lives in a cave and practices for 9 years, right? According to the story, whether you believe it or not. So cave practice. These solitary practitioners did originally a lot of cave practice, a lot of wilderness practice. And the cave, in a way, that represents the twilight zone between dark and light, between getting caught by the world and retreating from the world. The best time for meditation really is at dawn and dusk, because the mind much more easily just settles down when the sun is either settling down or just starting to rise. So anyway, we have this whole legacy in meditative practice of the solitary practitioner. Bodhidharma himself, no written text, no priestly attire, no ritual. Just practicing there, just being there, meditating for, according to the myth, 9 years. And looking a little more like a pirate than a monk or a priest, which is interesting. And then we have Buddha himself. Buddha's time, right? There were supposedly lots of enlightened Brahmins around. This is the age of the Vedanta. Vedantas were coming out, non-dualistic. But he went off on his own. Went off his own for 6 years. Did it on his own. With no ritual, with no enlightened teacher. Well, he tried a few teachers, but they didn't help him very much. And so this tradition has been maintained for hundreds and hundreds of years. And when I went to Bhutan 3 or 4 years ago, people would point out to me, they'd say, oh, up there, there's someone, he's been there 9 months. Oh, over there, you know, there are mountains all around. Over there, there's someone, oh, he's been there 6 months. And so they have really maintained that tradition of people going off and just meditating on their own, just doing it privately. And in our own culture, I don't know who we really have before Buddhism came into our culture. Maybe Thoreau would be an example. I think so. He could be an example. He practiced. He was very suspicious of organized religion, as you guys know, very suspicious. And he meditated by himself. he had friends who were similarly suspicious, and he spent time on Walden Pond, as you know. And you know, when he was dying, the story, which I guess is not apocryphal, really happened. This was in Puritan New England, so they called the minister to his bedside when he was dying, and the minister said, "Do you remember this story?" minister said, my son, have you made your peace with God? And Thoreau said, well, we have never quarreled. And the minister left fairly rapidly. So he was maintaining that pracheka, solitary, pracheka Buddha, pracheka jnana, solitary tradition, path of the solitary practitioner. And in the current issue of Buddha Dharma, which some of you may look at, there's a little section on unaffiliated practitioners. Well, unaffiliated practitioners, that kind of fits into this, unaffiliated. People who, I have a good friend who's a regular meditator. She sits every day, but she doesn't sit on a cushion. She sits in a nice comfy chair. But she sits every day. She has for years. She's not part of any organized group. Once in a great while comes to Zen Center. Is very, very devoted to it. It's kind of the key part of her life. But she doesn't have a sangha, doesn't have a teacher. And probably within the Buddhist world, the person who, the contemporary Buddhist world, the person who I think comes closest to sort of manifesting that tradition is Stephen Batchelor. Some of you know Stephen Batchelor. You know his work. Do you know Stephen Batchelor's work? Yeah.
Buddhism without belief.
Yeah, Buddhism without belief. Stephen Batchelor's attitude is that when he studies Buddhism, or when he teaches Buddhism, he only focus when he's looking at Buddhist teaching, he only focuses on the stuff that was unique to Buddha. That is, the stuff that was present in the culture at Buddha's time, like karma, like reincarnation, like ritual. He said, that's all irrelevant. I just want the core of it. And so he also doesn't... There are a lot of deities in Buddhism. Those of you who are new to Zen don't know about this, but if you've been in Zen for a while, you know there are deities all over the place. Well, from his point of view, that's just all Hindu stuff. That's just all Indian stuff. But that wasn't unique. That wasn't unique to Buddha. So as a solitary practitioner, you don't have to pay any attention to that stuff. You can, but there's no need to. It's not the path. The path is about coming back to just being here. Coming back to just being here again and again and again and again. What other vehicle helps you come back? You should use that vehicle. And during the course of my life, I've spent a lot of time doing the Sravakayana practice that I'm going to talk about next, the listener practice with Sangha and with teacher. But I've also spent some time doing the solo practice, more with retreats. But doing the solo practice, I found to be very hard. Now, it's one thing to have to sit in a nice armchair every morning and meditate, as my friend does. It's another thing to go try to do a solo retreat. First solo retreat I tried to do years ago was at the New Kamaldoli Hermitage, and they set me up. It was beautiful. It was right by the ocean, and they told me, you know, they brought me my meals. Oh, and I sat for 30 minutes, and then I went to sleep. And I slept about 12 hours by the ocean. You know, so I didn't have... So that was the beginning of my struggle with solo retreats. I still tried them, but I saw that for me, it was hard without the support of other people, without the support of a teacher. But it didn't mean that I didn't keep trying them. I did over the years, and I did a number of wilderness retreats, which were of... which I usually hung in, but it was hard for me to focus. It was hard for me just to be present with what was going on. Probably the one that was the most well, what would I say? The most gripping for me was the one that I did, a Lakota retreat I did. 4 days and four nights up on the hill in Indian reservation in South Dakota. And that one, I was able to focus. That way, I was all by myself up there, I was able to focus, but partly because I had been set up. There had been a teacher there who took me up there, and the space was made sacred, and I was told how I should behave in that space and what I should do, and so I had a structure. Problem with this solitary practice is that if you don't have structure, it's just easy to just go to sleep or just indulge yourself. It's hard enough with structure. Don't you think? So the practice of the pracheka, the solitary practice, it's harder, I think, if you really go into it, because you don't get encouragement from others. There can be more doubt, more loneliness, more confusion. That's okay. That's all grist for the mill. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. It's all grist for the mill if you could stay with it and not sleep the whole time. So that's the pracheka. Now I'm going to talk about the sravaka. The pracheka is a solitary. The sravaka is the listener, the person who is in community with a teacher. And I spend the rest of my time talking about that one, and then next time I'll talk about these in relation to the Bodhisattva Jhana, the third vehicle. So, Buddha himself supposedly did this 6 years of practice solo, and then he was so spacious and calm and open that he thought about not going back to the world at all, right? About just staying there, because it felt so wonderful. But then he did go back, and he did then have a sangha, recommend sangha practice, and he did then in his life talk about the importance of practicing in the world with other people. So a sangha is just the Buddhist term for any group of people who get together and make a commitment to meditate and to support each other in their meditation in a compassionate way without relying on slander or sarcasm. So slander and sarcasm comes up, but without relying on it, without trying to not be caught by it. Be non-grasping when it comes up, so that it's non-indulged. And of course, sanghas are just like villages. Villages that seem oh so quaint. And I remember going into little villages in northern Minnesota when I first came to Minnesota. I thought, wow, you know, surrounded by trees and lakes and rivers. These people are going to be just wonderful to live with. My God. You know, the kind of slander and sarcasm coming out of the... It wasn't coming out of the trees, though, you know. It's not the trees. It's the little villages. So we're a little village here. Little village. You know? We're human. And we need to support each other. But partly we're supporting each other in terms of helping each other deal with slander and sarcasm that comes up in this sort of intimate relationship that a sangha has, that a spiritual community has, just like a little village. So, that's grist for the mill. And from the Japanese Zen point of view, that's especially good grist for the mill. The Japanese Zen, my two Japanese Zen teachers, Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi, really emphasized sangha, doing things together, always sitting together, always just doing everything together. And when I would have issues, and I would come to Katagiri, he would say, "Oh, okay. Well, there you are, seeing your activity of the fictional self." Although he didn't use those words; those are my words, right? "Yeah, good. You know, seeing your activity of their self and yourself. Good. Don't go home. Stay here longer." Very much the Japanese Zen attitude. I can remember when we had 4 and 9 days at the Zen monastery in California. And 4 and 9 days are days when their schedule is really relaxed. And you have most of the day when you don't have anything scheduled. You just have a little sitting in the morning, a little sitting at night. And I'd want to go off and hike and just be by myself. And Suzuki would say, "Well, go with some other people." And sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't. So the Sangha maybe could be the great leveler of our ego idiosyncrasies. If we really do it, if we really do it with a wholehearted approach. And of course, we're not Japanese, so the Buddhism that's developing here now that many of our Japanese teachers are dead is not. We don't focus on everything looking the same in the Zendo, dressing the same, behaving the same, because our culture is different from Japanese. So that's important to recognize too. I think our Sangha is developing in a different way than their Sanghas did. But anyway, in this tradition, in this listener tradition, support of others is the key. Giving support to and getting support from others is the key. That's why we try to structure at Zen things at this Zen center as people, as they do at other Zen centers, to give adequate structure so that we have practice periods twice a year where we all come together and make a commitment together and work together, and we have a buddy system where we have buddies, beginner's mind every couple of weeks where people can come, and all of those things that are necessary. Really, for any discipline, it's better to have a community. My wife took up the flute when she was, 59 years old. Well, geez, that's cool. But she needed a community because she needed other people to do it with, because and that's really helped her. So, that's the community. That's the first key part of the listening tradition, of the Shravaka tradition. The second one is the teacher. And Lou Richmond has some thoughts about how to select a teacher. So I think these are cool, so I thought I would share them with you. They make sense to me. He says, first, watch how people are treated by the teacher. Watch how the teacher treats people. See if she's honest. See if he's honest. See if he or she uses others in the Sangha to get his or her ego needs met. Notice if that person really seems to speak from a place of stillness, a place of openness, a place of quiet content, or not. That's his first suggestion. His second suggestion is ask questions. Don't ask questions. See how the teacher responds. Does the teacher want to look good? Is that his main thing? Or want to fight? Want to get defensive? Or is the teacher able to empathize, to be present, to challenge, but not overdo it? Suzuki Roshi, my first teacher, he challenged me a lot, but mostly by not doing much of anything. not answering my questions very clearly or not. But he was always had integrity, and I could see later, not during the time I was with him, but later, that there was a point to most of what he did, not all of what he did, because he was human, not all of what he did, but a point, meaning a point, the point of helping you come back to just being here with this, whatever it is. So, also asking questions is important of other people than the teacher. Find out if there are any secrets. A lot of sanghas have had secrets, we know. They've kept secrets. And you can find out if they're secrets. If they're secrets, I wouldn't hang around if I were you, because it means there's something not okay. Well, you could hang around, but then you should bring the secret out. Then that's your role, to bring the secret out. That's cool. That's brave of you. Cool. And then thirdly, third criteria, how do you feel when you're with a teacher? Do you feel an affinity or not? Pretty simple. You feel an affinity. It doesn't have to be, just an affinity. An affinity. Fourthly, now we've gone through all these three steps. It's time to try it. We've done enough of this. You know, you can go on. I've seen people come and go from here for the last 30 years. You know, it's time for them to move on to number four, which is try it. Try it. There's me and there's several other teachers around the city. Just try it. Just come and have a one-to-one meeting with me. I do them. I'm doing them today. Hey. Just come for a retreat. Just do a class. Just do a practice period. Just try it. There should be no demand for irrevocable commitment from the teacher. If there is, watch out. Be careful. Be careful. That just is something that I would be just as careful of as I would the secret thing. And then finally, lastly, ready to make a commitment. Maybe not for life, but just a commitment. And I do a ceremony here every 2 years where I initiate people. It's called Jukai in Japanese Zen. They sew these roksus. But also the commitment can be informal. It doesn't have to be a formal commitment. It can be informal. Just yourself. Just yourself. And a good teacher will occasionally, at least, really sort of really pierce through your continual babbling, your continual. You know what I mean by babbling, don't you? I don't mean to demean it. Your continual self-scrutiny. Scrutiny would be more dignified. Your continual scrutiny of yourself and the world. A good teacher will do that. And Rumi has this poem that I like a lot. Let your throat song be clear and strong enough to make an emperor fall full length suppliant at the door. You that come to birth and bring the mysteries, your voice thunder makes us happy. Roar, lion of the heart, and tear me open. So, if you work with the teacher at some point, the clarity and the strength of some things the teacher says can have that kind of effect on you of tearing you open. When I was with Suzuki Roshi, I heard him give a talk. I heard him talk every day for like 2 months. It's saying the same thing over and over again in different ways. And the theme that summer was the everyday mind is the Buddha mind. The theme, the everyday mind is the Buddha mind. And so he kept talking about that and talking about that and talking about that. And of course, you know, these intellectually, that's not a very difficult concept to grasp. You kind of grasp it intellectually right away. Most people do, at least. But I kept thinking, gee, when is my everyday mind going to feel like the Buddha mind? When? All I've got is this anxiety. All I've got is this pain in my legs. All I've got is this comparing myself to these other students who seem to be sitting straighter or something than I am. When? But I kept listening. I kept taking it. I kept saying it to myself over and over again, sometimes with annoyance, sometimes with looking in, sometimes despair. And then at some point, one day, all of a sudden, I realized it was that very mind that was trying to figure this all out, that was trying not to be get away from the anxiety. It was the Buddha mind. It was the screwed up mind. It was the messed up mind. It was the paranoid mind. That is the Buddha mind. That, dear children, is the Buddha mind. But it takes a voice clear and strong enough to enter your psyche, which you allow to enter your psyche, which you allow to sit there among all the other thousands of voices in your psyche, until it really resonates, until it really, really resonates, and the other voices become not still, but more like straw dogs in the wind. More like straw dogs in the wind. So in a way, we talk about transmission in Zen. That's kind of what transmission is. I don't exactly know what it is, but I'm supposed to know. I'm giving transmission this year, so I should be knowing what it is. But that's kind of what transmission is. You something the teacher or the teaching or me or another teacher says, and you let it in, and you let it percolate, and you keep working with it, and you keep letting it percolate. And then at some point, that voice that goes with you, you realize is your own voice. It's your own voice. And not your own in terms of grasping, your own in terms of just open. Of course, if you make a big deal out of it, then it turns into a small, little grasping voice again. But it happens. It happens. So there's some limitations to this path, as there are to all paths, as there are to all vehicles, to this listening path, to this being involved in a sangha, being involved with a teacher. And after a while, often you just think, I've had enough, I'm out of here. I know that. I've been through that. Unfortunately, I can't do that in this case. I suppose I could. I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to. One is a con that, taking in what the teacher has to say and letting it settle and letting it transform your psyche, that's great. But we shouldn't abandon our own good judgment. If you abandon your own good judgment, then it's not so good, not so healthy. Because then you maybe become a clone of the teacher, a clone of the tradition, rather than your own authentic voice, clear and strong, tearing open all of this constricted material that you review and rehearse. And and the second limitation of this path this vehicle, is conceit and arrogance that come up about it. Conceit and arrogance. Look at the hubris of the Mahayanists. We're Mahayanists. What hubris to say we've got the vehicle? You know, it's the great big Mahayana means beyond big, right? It's our vehicle. What hubris? What hubris of the Vajrayanas to say, oh, Mahayana, yeah, that's okay. Yeah, and that Hinayana, oh, that was barely okay. But we're the tantric warriors. What hubris, right? What hubris? Something you really have to pay attention to if you get involved in spiritual practice. It's the most important thing, I think, to pay attention to. My wife has been working with people in Sri Lanka for the last year. She doesn't go to Sri Lanka herself. I think she's kind of scared to go there. But she works with the Nonviolent Peace Force. And there they have a huge group in Sri Lanka. And you know the Buddhists, you know what the Buddhists have been doing to the Hindus in Sri Lanka for, what, I don't know, 20, 30 years? They've been making war on them. And they've, you know, so Buddhists are not any better. Yeah, not any better. So, but this is the human situation. This is the human situation. And the pros of this approach, of this Shravakayana approach, this listening involved in community with a teacher, are that in contrast to the solitary one, you get all kinds of reminders when you go off. All kinds of ways to help you come back, to help you practice with others, to help you pay attention. And I think that's invaluable. I don't have the fortitude to have been able to do just the solitary one for my whole life. I couldn't have done it. And even Thoreau, I'm just not sure about Thoreau. I've been reading him again, and you know, I have to say, sometimes there's a little bit of hubris in there. A little bit of hubris. A little bit of, you know, I've got it figured out. I don't need any of that stuff. I never quarreled with God. Oh, come on. Come on. Come on. Come on, Henry David. You never quarreled with God? I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Both of these paths require meditation practice, daily meditation practice of some sort or other. Some sort or other. Doesn't. What sort it is, doesn't matter. But something. Something so that you can see the grasping. You can see the grasping. You can cool the grasping down by blowing, by focusing on your breath, by doing something, some other practice, and let go of the hypnotic trance that this is going on in here with this guy or lady or all these people who are running around telling you stuff, right? And both of them require doing some retreats. I mean, not require, it's just that if you want to really make movement from samsara, which is way out there, to nirvana, which is right here, it's necessary. Especially necessary in the 21st century. Cell phones, iPhones, text messaging. I was reading some literature the other day on how hard it is for people to concentrate on anything now for more than an hour or for a full hour. They were doing some tests on people who are internet connected without looking at their email, without looking at their iPhone, so we need this more and more than ever, this practice, because we're getting so much more scattered and so much harder for us just to be with what is. So retreats, and at Zen Center, that's actually I have not been leading too many retreats lately, but that's because I and giving other people a chance to do them. But I think that's the way I prefer to teach. That's what I like best, is to get a bunch of people together, and then we're just quiet for a half day or a day or 2 days or 5 days or 7 days. Because I think we need it if we're going to commit ourselves to this path. After all, the Buddhist tradition originally, until very recently, was a monastic tradition. It was a monastic tradition. It still is a monastic tradition. Well, we're doing this in the city. And that's cool. I love doing it in the city. That's mostly what I've done it my whole life. But if we don't do the monastic component at all, if we don't do the retreat at all, we won't get a taste of just the simplicity of being present with life. And the Buddhist tradition is considered the oldest monastic tradition, which has not changed its tenets, its original tenets. So that's basically what I want to say. And the next time I'm going to talk about the Bodhisattva Yana, the Bodhisattva vehicle. I think I'll close with a quote from Dogen. Zen practice is not a technique. If it were a technique... let me finish the quote. Zen practice is not a technique, but the Dharma gate of enjoyment and ease. So we're not trying to accomplish something. We're not trying to get somewhere. We're just learning how to enjoy and be at ease with whatever is. It's very simple. Very simple. But very hard for us. Very hard for us. That's all I want to say today. Be glad to entertain questions or comments on Mother's Day. Yeah.
You're talking about a volunteering practice. You reminded me of how people will come here to learn how to meditate, and then they'll bring it home, and they'll never come back.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of modern day volunteer practice. You know, they're not in the food or whatever. But I think to myself how, in a way, that's kind of selfish practice. Because when you're here, maybe you think, oh, I don't need to go to a Zen center because I have all the tools I need to practice at home.
Uh-huh.
But when you're here, you're really helping other people to be here as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't, like, for example, if I showed up at a retreat and there was just me and the teacher here, you know, that would be kind of a letdown.
If you did what?
If I showed up for a retreat and it was just me and a teacher.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Usually we have 20, 30 people here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so being a part of a sangha to me is more important that I'm just here to help others also be here.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could go home and never show up at a Zen.
Well, that's wonderful. So she's fully committed to the Shravaka path, to the listening path. And that's cool. Good for you. I love you. But some people will not be committed to that. Some people will be committed to a more solitary way. They'll come here on a Sunday, and then they'll stop. They'll go visit some other centers, and then they'll develop their own practice, and they'll do it on their own. And that's fine, but then they have to figure out how to get retreats in, too. If they go do these solo retreats like I used to do, that's cool. It's just much harder that way, but it can be done. So I appreciate what you say, but I also want to go back to the fact that the solitary practitioner that's a noble path, too. I think it is. Just harder. About what?
Thoreau.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the story that I like to tell myself about the transcendentalist is the emissary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thoreau's teacher, and he owned the property of all the bonds and kind of set him up.
And Emerson did, yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Emerson, it seems, was also a proponent of being at peace with yourself inside.
That's right. Yes, so what you're saying in a way is that they had their own little sangha. I mean, I've often thought Thoreau, Emerson, Whitman, but Thoreau and Emerson were very close. They had their own little sangha. Is that your point?
That is my point, and what Thoreau did have a teacher. Like when you talk about the quote of the tree.
Yeah.
There was a structure.
Well, that's true. That's true. That's true. So this, I think if we take this solitary practitioner to an extreme, it doesn't work. That is, even my friend, every morning when she does her meditation, does a little reading first to help her focus. So I think there's always needs to be some component of being in the world, and hopefully the solitary practitioner will still relate to his or her family with more grace, with more ease. And will be actually part of a sangha. They just don't know it. It's just not a formal sangha. Yeah.
I think it's really good not to judge, though, the different vehicle. I mean, you started with
that. Yeah.
And somebody to find peace within themselves,
mm-hmm.
that means they're consuming less, they're supporting less war, they're not destroying.
Yeah.
And that's a very general
thing. Yeah.
That's a very supportive thing.
That's right. Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so next week I'm going to talk about the Bodhisattva one, which of course, before you answer your question, Tucker. Next time I'm going to talk about the Bodhisattva one, which the Mahayanists think is the best. It's the one. These others, the Bodhisattva. And from my point of view, I better not do that because that's my next talk. Okay. Instead, I'll answer Tucker's question or listen to what Tucker has to say.
Probably an intro to the Bodhisattva, because we were talking about some of these singular practices, and I think of other people like John Muir, Ansel Adams. She was right on my mind, who out of New Mexico, Georgia O'Keeffe. Beautiful paintings came out of solitary.
Yeah.
They were also part of a community.
That's right.
They had a song of it.
That's right.
Even Steinbeck was part of it.
That's right.
He would go off on his own and write beautiful
poems. That's right. Yes.
Came out of that.
Yes.
And that has influenced, by them being Bodhisattva of sorts, have influenced the path that I take, in that I use the brushstroke of O'Keeffe or the light of Ansel Adams in his pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Just the tracking that Muir did,
as
part of journeying through life.
And yeah.
And it brings up a whole wonderful experience.
That
it isn't just because their interconnectedness, even being solitary, it influenced so many other people. So.
That's good. Thank you. Yeah. Elizabeth.
Is this part of how Zen has evolved in this country? Because if you have my experiences elsewhere with what we would call ethnic Buddhism,
mm-hmm.
where the monastic tradition carries the whole
yes.
community,
yes.
The lay people, the householders don't meditate.
Yes.
And that was a controversial thing in this country. When we began to apply Buddhism to people like us who go to work, who have
yes.
family commitments, who have very busy lives and can't spend the time with someone in a country with us, where the monastic tradition is really the core of Buddhism. And is that part of what we're involved in?
That's exactly part of what we're involved in. And it began, 60 years ago? It's 70 years ago, first with D.T. Suzuki and then Shinryu Suzuki and the Japanese lay people never sit in meditation, or seldom. They've been learning to sit in meditation. You know why they've been learning? Because of us. Because they found out, Americans are sitting in meditation. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we could do that too. but there's been this bifurcation in Buddhism for hundreds of years between the monastic, order that kind of, it's kind of like the Benedictines, you know, they maintain the practice, people support the Benedictines, but they don't do the practice themselves.
Well, the difference between a Christian community, a cloistered community, like the Carmelites.
Right, right, right. Now that...
The left-leaning sisters who have contributed so much to the culture.
Do it as what?
Who have contributed so much to the culture
yeah.
in terms of education. And
yes, yes. Yes, yes. Yes, yes. That's right. The difference in Buddhism, though, was that conceptually, for 2,000 years, we've been talking about the oneness of samsara and nirvana. We've been talking about laymen like Vimalakirti, who were deeply enlightened, and layman Pong. So it's always been part of our tradition, but we just haven't done it too much because of the monastic. Everybody has just supported the monastic until the United States, until 1960, and now we've been doing it for almost 50 years. Is that right? Almost 50 years. Yeah.
Because I don't live with you all. I mean, in my family, uh-huh. so I don't live with you like.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So if I come here.
Yeah. So this
person
is
in a physical, literal way, but I'm sure you with me when I'm not.
So this is an experiment, and of course. On the West Coast and the East Coast, they have these monasteries that you can go to.
Mm-hmm.
Where I practiced Tassajara when I was young. So their practice period will be at the monastery. So our experiment is to try to do these practice periods in the city where we still go to work. But it's the spirit, again, of non-duality. It's the spirit of Vimalakirti, to be in the world but not of it. It's just that it hasn't been practiced. It's just been talked about a lot, but not done too much. Does that make sense? Okay, I think that's enough conversation, you guys.
I just wanted to say, though, you know, the Quakers have kind of come
back. Yes, yes. That's right. That's right.
Our two grandchildren go to the friend school, the Quaker school.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Years ago, I mean, seventh grade, one to four. Anyway, some years ago, I became aware of they do a meditation in the big room for I don't know how long, almost an hour or something. I just thought, gosh,
uh-huh.
This is about
yes.
how they have all their different
yes.
things and what these and this, and then they do this meditation.
Yes, that's good.
It is, and I asked Henry, I said, second grade, I said, what is it? Why? What is it? I mean, what do you do?
Oh,
crap, he says, it's where we all get together and sit in this room for a long time, and we try to talk to our friends the best way we can without getting caught.
They
get as much noise and thought without getting caught. That was it.
Yeah, so with my own children, I used to bring them to this Zen center, but you know, they were not that interested in the sitting. So I would try to find times like when we were outdoors, when we could just lie and look at the sky together. Sometimes 2 minutes, we'd all lie quietly and look at the sky, because when you force this on kids, they just. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.